Not that anyone necessarily needed reminding, but John Gosnell proved at this year's Breeders' Cup that not only is he one of the most gifted trainers in the sport, he is among the most durable. Way back in 1984, the then 33-year-old trainer won a race at the inaugural Breeders' Cup with Royal Heroine at Hollywood Park. Fast forward to 2018 in the 35th Breeders' Cup, and there was John Gosden back in the winner's circle with a phenomenal filly in Able. A trainer has won far more than his fair share of big races all over the world. John Gosden is our guest on this week's Thoroughbred Daily News podcast, brought to you by TaylorMade.
Family-owned and operated since 1976, TaylorMade has dedicated the past three decades to serving clients and helping make equine dreams come true. No other agency has sold more Grade 1 winners, more graded stakes winners, or more Breeders' Cup champions than TaylorMade. Visit us at the sales or online at TaylorMadeFarm.com and discover what TaylorMade can do for you.
Welcome back. This is Bill Finley, the host of the TDN podcast, and we're overjoyed to be joined by John Gosden this week, whose Enable was nothing short of electric in the Breeders' Cup turf. Before we get to John, let's hear how Enable fought her way to victory at Churchill Downs.
Meanwhile, Enable at this stage of the race is seventh, and she's three lengths off the lead, running in behind horses, moving for the far turn. Let's see where she goes from here. Around the turn they go, and High Happy has taken the lead. Hunting Horn is second, and now Frankie Dettori brings Enable to the outside of them, and here she comes up for the lead as they come to the top of the stretch. Magical's moving with her, and she got an inside run, and they're into the stretch, and the two fillies are 1-2, Magical and Enable, and they kick on from Saddler's Joy. It's Enable on the outside, in the center of the turf course. She has taken the lead, and she's pulling away from Magical, who continues to battle her, though. It's these two, 1-2, down to the finish. Enable and Magical, and they're well clear of the others. Racing royalty, Enable and Frankie Dettori. The Arc winner is the Breeders' Cup turf winner, too.
And John, coming in, you certainly knew that no Arc winner had ever come back to win the Breeders' Cup turf. Did you ever worry that those two back-to-back races were too much for any horse to handle, Enable included?
Well, obviously, they come, you know, deep into the autumn. And normally, they probably have had a great deal more racing than she had this year. We obviously had a well-publicized injury we had to deal with back in May, which required surgery, but she came through all of that. It was more of a bursa problem at the back of the knee than it wasn't a ligament bone as such. But she came through all of that. We got her back and ran her in a grade three just to get her started back at Kempton, and she did that well. Then our problem was then between that race and the Arc, she had a fever and she was on the easy for a week. So I think my biggest problem was going to the Arc, running the filly not fully 100%. And she certainly she burst away from the field, but just certainly was tiring inside the last eighth. And the jockey we sticked down and picked her up and got her over the line. And I suppose that took her longer to get over than would be normal, because if you run a horse in a mile and a half race of that class and they're a little short of work due to the time she missed, it is going to take her longer, and there's no doubt that she took longer to get over that. So, but I was happy with her by the time she got on the plane to go to Kentucky.
John, as you mentioned, the Breeders' Cup turf was only her third race of the year. At the same time, you laid out a scenario where she had had an arduous campaign, but nonetheless, the fact that it was only the third race has to mean she was relatively fresh. If so, how much of a difference did that make?
I think it helped, but it's a strange thing to say. She, last year as a three-year-old, she ran in all the big races, beat all the fillies, then she beat all the colts, all the three-year-olds, all the older horses. And strangely enough, it was a very smooth year. And although she raced a whole lot more, funnily enough, I probably would have preferred to have bought her the Breeders' Cup last year, because I had everything going smoothly. I hadn't had any hiccups and she was in great form. So this year, strangely, was a lot more testing. It was never the intention to only start her back in September. And obviously, it wasn't the intention in between in between her prep race to the Arc, getting a little sick on us. So I suppose, and the truth is, we've been what we call on the back foot all the way this year, but still she managed to pull the irons out of the fire.
Okay. And as the race developed, Frankie Dettori made a strategic move that he could have been second-guessed for. Coming out of the final turn or going into the final turn, he was literally 9 or 10 wide, losing a lot of ground. But he explained later that he was looking for the better footing of the course, which he apparently found. But at the time, were you wondering, what the heck is Frankie doing? And were you at some point worried about that decision?
Well, he didn't have much choice. He was being attended by Huntinghorn on his outside, and the speed was going to stop the pace they'd gone in that ground. And the one thing he didn't want to be do was squeezed down closer towards the inside the edge and have those horses come back in his face and he be checked in behind them. He was very clear in his mind that, yes, he wanted to stay away from the fence, but secondly, he didn't want to get in behind that speed, which was bound to be stopping. So he elected then to come take a pull, if you look at it very carefully. Coming to the last turn, he took a pull and came back around Huntinghorn and came on his outside. So he knew, although he sacrificed ground and momentum, he knew he would get a clear run. I don't think he intended to come as wide as he came, but when Huntinghorn opened the door for Magical, that pushed him even wider. I was pleased myself they didn't wind up on the main track, actually. I thought that was the next stop.
Right. Well, it certainly worked out in your favor as she, of course, got into the winner's circle. Now, John, going back to what you said earlier about the problems you had in the surgery, at that point when she was injured and you had to tell the world that they wouldn't be seeing her for quite some time back on the race course, could you ever have imagined that the end of the year would end up as successfully as it did, 3 for 3, including winning two of the most prestigious turf races in the world?
Well, I suppose you don't think like that as a trainer. You're there and you think if we get back to the races, you're thinking, well, that'll be great in itself. I suppose you always have faith. With a filly like this, not only does she have the ability, but she has enormous mental strength. I mean, she really enjoys her training. She loves breezing. She loves racing. So it's like you've got someone, she's up for it. She's going to give you everything, rather like any athlete coming back from an injury. A lot of it is down to mental strength as well as the physical healing, and she manages to combine both. And I suppose the interesting thing, we have a large trotting ring here that the horses pull out on in the morning and have a walk, they have a little jog, and they go out on the heath. And I had to actually put her inside a big covered ride when she was in light exercise, because the moment those horses left that trotting room to go out onto the Newmarket Heath here to train, she got in a real temper that she couldn't go with them. So in the end, I had to hide her from them. And she was that kind of filly. And to the extent that whatever you do with her, she gives you 100% every time. So she did make that side of it a lot easier than someone who didn't have that mental fortitude.
Well, you might have already touched on this, and with the truly great horses, normally it's more than just raw talent. There's an intrinsic trait that they bring to the table that maybe more ordinary horses don't. In her case, is that this mental toughness that you've been talking about?
Yeah, I think it is this very competitive spirit, a very strong mind, one that likes the pressure of competition and deals with it. I think there are a lot of, like a lot of human athletes, you only have to watch even a game, golf game, or any of the big games we all play, whether it's football or whatever. And particularly in tennis would be another one. You can see that mental strength is the difference between the greats and the goods. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that.
And John, as I mentioned in our opening, you were there at the very beginning, winning with Royal Heroine. 35 years later, there's very few trainers around from that inaugural Breeders' Cup that are even still active. Yet here you are 35 years later in 2018, still winning. And it looks like you might win Breeders' Cup for many years to come. That 35-year feat, winning at the first Breeders' Cup and the most recent Breeders' Cup, have you allowed yourself to relish in that feat at all? Is it something that's crossed your mind?
Well, it's an interesting, I hadn't thought of it in those terms. I suppose, I was lucky to be around people like Charlie Whittingham and Bill Shoemaker and that wonderful jocks from back on the West Coast then. And we spent a lot of time together. And I always remember Charlie and I going down to Florida once, and a fellow said to us, we landed, we had a stopped in the bar to have a quick one from your bed. And the guy said, have you won the Kentucky Derby? And Charlie looked and he said, no. And then the guy said, well, you ain't no trainer. Well, I remember Charlie was not amused by that. But I turned up with him in about 86, and he had a horse called Ferdinand. Mm-hmm. I had a horse called Sabaleta, who was in the auxiliary. And I said, Charlie, one thing, this horse, he won't get the mile and a quarter. By God, he'll take you through the three quarters in nine and change. And he did. And Charlie went and trained his first Kentucky Derby winner in his 70s, and his second, of course.
So right.
I always feel in this game, if you can hang in there long enough, with a bit of luck, you might get better.
There you go. John, in here in the U.S., there's quite a debate about who should win the Eclipse Award for the champion filly or mare turf. In many years, Enable would be a shoe-in, even though she only raced here once, but you have very stiff competition in Sister Charlie, another Breeders' Cup winner. Would you like to weigh in on that debate? And how do you feel about the possibility of Enable, who's already won a Cartier Award, winning an Eclipse Award as well?
Well, I think I can see the argument on both sides. I mean, she comes to being a dual arc winner and winning the turf. On the other hand, I have a great understanding of a filly that is trained and race throughout the year in America, and to that extent, the Eclipse Award is for the American racing of that year. So I can see it's a very strong argument for the filly that's been based there with Chad all along. So put it this way, I'm not the one who has to make that decision, thank goodness.
Well, it'll be a fun race to watch nonetheless. Now, John, after the Breeders' Cup, you and the Judmont team were somewhat noncommittal about her future. Anything more to tell us at this point about whether or not we'll see her next year?
Actually, the filly's come back fine. She's in great order. We've gone over fully with the vets and everything to check everything. That decision is pretty fairly imminent. It'll come up very soon, but it rests entirely with her owner breeder, Prince Khalid, who I believe is in Paris at the moment.
Okay, well, we sure hope to see her back next year, and we'll stay tuned for that. There's plenty more to come with John Gosden, but first this message from our friends at TaylorMade.
Why do TaylorMade horses sell for nearly double the market average? A history of success, honesty, and hard work. For over 40 years, buyers and sellers alike have trusted TaylorMade as the industry's top source for high-quality thoroughbreds and friendly service. While sellers get top dollar for their horses, buyers are rewarded for top results on the track. From sale toppers to Grade 1 winners to Breeders' Cup champions, think TaylorMade, the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing.
On the right, here comes Roaring Lion inside the final quarter, and it's Century Dream by two lengths to Recolitos and Roaring Lion. Stormy Antarctic stays on. Century Dream is coming back to them. Roaring Lion with the big challenge. Recolitos and I Can Fly on the far side. Roaring Lion is beginning to get up from Century Dream. Well inside the final furlong, I Can Fly fast time. It's getting really tight, but Roaring Lion, the star of the season.
You just heard Roaring Lion when the Queen Elizabeth II Stakes at Ascot. It was such a huge win for the son of Kitten's Joy that he earned a Cartier Award as Europe's Horse of the Year. In fact, Gosden-trained horses won 5 Cartier Awards. Considering that, John, was this your best year ever as a trainer?
Probably close to it. I've had some pretty exciting years, but I suppose if you win 5 of the 8 awards, which are equivalent to the Eclipse Awards, I think you've got to think that's going to take a bit of topping. And the great thing is, they were the Kitten's Joy horse, Roaring Lion. He came out of the Keenan September sales, very, cleverly bought there and bred out by Ranjan Racing. But then, of course, the other ones were all owner breeder horses and all different owners. I suppose it is something exciting when they're all owned and bred by different people.
Now, I would never ask you to compare horses, but among the European racing fraternity and the voters and et cetera, was it somewhat of a surprise that Roaring Lion beat out Enable for the Horse of the Year?
Not really, because in a sense, it's rather the question you asked me earlier about the fillies of the turf. He raced from April. He was in classic trials. He ran in the classics, the Guineas, the Derby. He didn't stay the mile and a half, came back to a mile and a quarter, and then he beat everything at a mile and a quarter in 4 grade ones on the trot, all of our big races, if you like, the Eclipse, the Judmont International, the Irish champion. And then we dropped him to a mile because we had a lot of rain, and the mile and a quarter at Ascot goes down to something called Swinley Bottom, and it's not called that for nothing. It was very heavy ground there, and he doesn't like that. And then he managed to come back and then win over a mile, in the Queen Elizabeth II Stakes with the Queen herself there. So I think when a horse has battled like that through all those races, and he ran, 9 times this year, I think to that extent, you can understand why the award went in that direction. But I'm told it was a close decision, mm-hmm. a short head, I'm told, a nose.
Okay. Now, you have not only did you have all these Cartier winners this year, you have now trained four of the last five Cartier Horse of the Years, and you yourself were champion trainer in Great Britain in 2018 for the third time. At age 67, in most people's career, that's when you start slowing down, yet it seems that you've never been more dominant, and that's saying something with the bar set so high to begin with. What's the secret?
Well, the secret is to love what you're doing. And I can't tell you about all the, you know, whether it was Woody Stevens, all those guys. They you know, if you can go there in the morning and work away and people are kind enough to send you horses despite your age, I tell you what, sometimes a little bit of experience helps and a little bit of knowledge. But there's no doubt you've got a great team with you. We've got a lovely stables here. My wife helps me run the whole thing, Rachel. We've been together for, I dare mention it, 43 years, 44 years now. So to that extent, it's very, you know, it's exciting. I love it. I love being with the young horses and developing them and see how they come through. And to that extent, it's great that one can keep doing it. I don't think you feel your years when you're around horses. They keep you young.
Now, it's also been said that you, perhaps better than any other trainer, understand what races are good fits for your horses. And a prime example was Raven's Pass in the 2008 Breeders' Cup Classic. First, let's listen in to the stretch run, Raven's Pass winning that classic.
Raven's Pass, but now it's Curlin made this huge run. Can he go on? Whip comes out on him. Raven's Pass down the center. Henry the Navigator's running on. Colonel John on the inside. Curlin now in deep order. He has to dig deep, but it's going to be Raven's Pass to take him on along the inside. Henry the Navigator's coming home gamely as well, but it's going to be Raven's Pass to win it. Raven's Pass and Frankie Dettori have won the Classic.
Now, John, that was a horse that had never run on a synthetic surface, only on grass, and had never run beyond a mile. Conventional wisdom was the Breeders' Cup mile would have been the right fit for that horse. You thought outside the box, ran in the Classic, and won it. Could you take us through that year and that whole thinking of why you did what you did with Raven's Pass, which obviously worked out to perfection?
Well, I always felt that the mile and a quarter was within his compass, particularly on an oval track with just two turns. He had been winning mile races and very over what we call stiff, demanding miles, like the old mile at Ascot, which climbs 160 feet. So, I mean, that takes a bit of getting. And to that extent, I knew that was well within his compass. Of course, I was attracted by the fact that it was Zenyatta's track, the synthetic, and that I knew that our style of racing of sitting off the pace and then exploding the last part would really, really suit him. Rather than if you're on the dirt, you've got to be up there, you know, on those early fractions. He could do them, but then I knew this way, ridden the way Frankie rode him that day, that he'd finish out very strongly. And interesting enough, my main rival over here, Aidan, he had a horse in there, Henry the Navigator, who wound up being second, I think, ridden by John Velasquez. Mm-hmm. And Curlin was in there. And it ran a great race, but I remember Curlin's owner saying to me, "Help! We don't like running on this plastic. We prefer the dirt."
Yes, of course, which he said about Rachel Alexander many times as well, the late Jess Jackson. Now, going back to your years in California, that must have been something else. You called Santa Anita your second home, even many years after you relocated in Europe. So what kind of thrill, smile, excitement was involved with winning at that particular racetrack and winning a Breeders' Cup race there?
Well, I think to win the Classic back at Santa Anita was, to me, it was like closing the circle. I've always had a deep affinity and love for American racing. I lived there in Los Angeles. And the great thing about that old circuit, you know, we'd all be together, jockeys, trainers, all of us. And between Santa Anita, Hollywood Park, and Del Mar, it was a wonderful circuit. And probably nearly the finest group of jockeys ever put together. I remember Angel Cordero used to come over every winter and find it hard to get rides. So it was a great, great golden era. You couldn't. It would take you three goes to get in the non-winners of three other than. I mean, the races, the stalls, everything was filled, and it was highly competitive. But boy, was it exciting. So to go back to a place that you love so much, and I cut my teeth there. And coming from England, people were incredibly welcoming and And a lot of really good friends, some not with us anymore, but Obviously, it's a place that my heart has always been there.
Switching subjects now, you're a staunch advocate of not allowing race day medication. Matter of fact, you've been a fairly staunch advocate of not allowing race day medication. It's not an issue in Europe, but what are your thoughts about U.S. racing, considering you've had such a background here and it's rather lax drug rules?
Look, I can understand the therapeutic reasons for race day medication, be it Lasix or anything. I do understand that profoundly. And the benefit it can give. I just begin to find it difficult to think of any other athletic sport where the athlete is receiving intravenous injection the day of the race. I find that a little hard to mentally get my head around. I know the tracks are demanding, and I know that there's a requirement for it, and obviously with anti-inflammatories as well. I do understand it, and I understand the benefits of it, but it's going to come a time when people are increasingly going to question it, you know.
Right.
And similarly, we have the other debate here with the use of the whip. There's been enormous criticism of Christoph Ride in the Classic, where he went pretty hard at it. And, of course, in Europe, that would have been thrown out and he'd have been in big trouble. And it was strange to a lot of people watching from Europe that the stewards in Kentucky had nothing to say about it. So, and I think we have to be aware that a lot of attitudes are changing, and it's not just all about perception. There's some substance in it as well. And to that extent, I think we need to be a little bit more ahead of the curve rather than get behind it.
Well, sort of staying on the same wavelength of the animal rights issues and the drugs and whatnot, it's very interesting. Recently in South Africa, they experimented with their first ever whip-free race. Their most prominent trainer, Michael de Kock, was one of the people that was behind that. Would you like to see European racing maybe do something similar and see how that goes over?
I don't think you need to go that extreme. I fully understand we have this air cushioned whip here and everything. No one ever wants to see a horse being punished or hurt, okay? Mm-hmm. But if you're a jockey in a race and you're in there tight, sometimes you need something just to straighten the horse up. I mean, there's a safety issue apart from anything else. The great jockeys, if you watch them, they change hands. You watch McCarron in his heyday through a race, he changed hands, keep picking a horse up. He went to the stick as a last recourse, the last place to go. There has been a tendency amongst a lot of riders, and Gary Stevens would tell me this, that the first place they go is for the stick, and that is way too soon. You know, riding, you watch Shoemaker, how he was very clever, and then he'd, with his hands, then wave it, then flick it, and then he'd pull that stick through when someone had gone past him half a length, wave it at old John Henry, another horse, just wave it at his left eye. He'd come back and beat the other horse in the neck. There's a lot of artistry involved in the use of it. You'd never want to see that taken away, but it's just when it's used purely as a weapon to really batter a horse, and it's not done in a stylish fashion, but repeatedly. And we were shocked, obviously, some of the so-called great rides given to horses, just how many times they do get hit in America. And that doesn't sit too well here in Europe. You can call us namby-pamby, but I feel that public opinion will swing against what we're talking about.
More going down memory lane with John Gosden about his early years in California when we come back. But first, this message from TaylorMade.
And here it is. The 37-year wait is over. American Fair.
Over the past four decades, TaylorMade has risen from a small boarding operation to the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing. Here's Hall of Fame trainer Jerry Hollendorfer.
TaylorMade sales follow many horses that are training at the racetrack, and they are particularly adept at evaluating mares and placing them with a proper stallion after their racing careers are over. They are very straightforward and are also experts on confirmation of younger weanlings and yearlings.
My name is Tia Andrini, and I am from San Mateo, California. I've been doing business with TaylorMade for about a year now, and it's been one great experience after another. It started with my first TaylorMade venture when I bought an interest in the filly Catherine Sophia, which ultimately landed me 3 weeks later in the middle of the winner's circle of the 2016 Kentucky Oaks with her. The TaylorMade team is a group of truly outstanding individuals. They are knowledgeable, professional, and completely customer service driven. To me, the TaylorMade name epitomizes the term trusted advisor. That is exactly what they are, and I am very proud to be associated and doing business with them.
Discover what TaylorMade can do for you. Visit TaylorMadeFarm.com.
Born and raised in the UK, John, what made you decide to begin your training career in California, which I believe you came there in 1979?
Yeah, I did, actually. I came in 78.
Okay.
I'd fallen in love with a girl who's my wife, and she was at Cambridge University, and she's a little lawyer, but she was always in London, and I was either in Ireland with Vincent O'Brien, or I was in Newmarket or something, and we could never be together. And the great thing about coming to America, we thought we'd come and have a look for a year, that she could actually go working in Century City, Beverly Hills, which she did, and I could just drive to the track. And so we could be together. And interesting enough, that was one of the main reasons. I had worked with Gene Jacobs and everyone in New York in my school holidays, hot walking, traveling horses. So I had a lot of a feel for American racing. And the other factor is purely financial. To set up in Europe, you need to rent a place, buy a place. I didn't have the money for that. The great thing was I came to Santa Anita and was with Tommy Doyle and things. Then I got three stalls in Willard Proctor's barn.
Mm-hmm.
And Willard wasn't too keen to see me. But having said that, you go in there and you start the same as everyone else. You know, I was the hot walker. I had one groom. And then if an exercise rider came by, I got him hop up on a horse. And the great thing is you start from the bottom on a level playing field. And it was a very, very good system. And I, as I said earlier, people were so welcoming and so kind that in the end, I knew I made the right decision. And it was here I couldn't begin to do it.
Okay. Now, you got an education there in California that few European trainers have had the chance to have. All these years later, did you learn anything that you apply now to your training career, and anything that maybe is an advantage where your education maybe helps you in ways where you can accomplish things that maybe some other European trainers can't?
I would always say that, broadly speaking, in America, you train around soundness a lot of the time with the tracks and the demands of it. And here we train, remember, a little bit around the climate. We have, you know, some tough winters, springs. We can't go to California and Florida. And you're trying to bring these horses along through the spring, and then our racing is pretty well finished come, you know, late October. So to that extent, you have a tighter window here, but the golden rules exist. You have happy, healthy, sound horses, you win races at any level. And those same principles exist, and the one that you always learn with horses, patience and more patience. And I think the ability you learn when to go forward with a horse, when to hit the pause button, when to go backwards, when to back off, all of those things you learn. And it's a lot of it is instinct, but a lot of it is experience. And I've been lucky being around some of the trainers I've watched and seen and been friends with. So, yeah, you pick those things up, and then a lot of it, in the truth be known, Bobby Frankel was a good friend of mine. You know, he was instinctively a superb trainer. And very much, you know, and I remember him in Aqueduct many years ago kicking an ice bucket out of the way when he had a couple of claimers when I was about 18, 19 years old, and I was hot walking there for Gene Jacobs at Aqueduct. So, you know, you go back a long time, you learn things, you watch, and the great thing is that so many of those people were very good friends.
Now, John, you were an assistant trainer to Tommy Doyle, but it's also known that you watched intently what Charlie Whittingham did. And you are more perhaps well-known for your association with Charlie even than your association with Tommy Doyle, because you did have such a fondness for him and an appreciation for what a great trainer he is. What did you learn from him? What are the key lessons you learned from watching this great trainer train horses?
I did ask him for job twice, but he always had too many people, so they never get in. So when I started training, the easiest thing to do was to get my little sets out and go out with him. And I always knew where I belong, right in the back of his set. So I used to walk out there five sets a day, walk around with him, walk back. And, What would you learn from Charlie? You would learn everything about the understanding of a horse, the animal. He was a huge lover of horses, dogs, people. His humor was one of the greatest. No one had a better sense of humor, dry. He was tough, and yet he was very soft and kind underneath. But he really knew how to get those horses absolutely perfect. Mm-hmm. And he was a man that would never be in a hurry with a horse, never be in a hurry. But when he knew he was in the right place with one, oh boy, you better watch out.
Right.
And I suppose we had a lot of fun together, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he wasn't partying so much in those days. So he used to check my eyes in the morning first thing and say, John, it's the old story. You can't hoot with the owl and soar with the eagle.
Okay, that's a great line. Now, in the back of your mind, do you always know you'd return to the UK? Or I know some big opportunities arose for you. Were your plans to be a permanent U.S. trainer?
I think, my wife was busy and running an important business there and in real estate and legal stuff. And I think to that extent, she was doing well, and I was having a great run and loving every minute of it and doing well on all the old charts and things. And I think, no, we were pretty well intent on staying, but the family kept saying, you've got to come back, got to come back, you know, we've got kids now, we used to have them back here, and they were all missing us. So there was that pressure. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid, he then, they made a proposal to come back and train at the very beautiful stables in Newmarket. And I thought, okay, we better go back. So I came back, and for the next 5 years, I regretted every minute of it.
Really? Why is that?
Oh, yeah. No, I missed America enormously. Okay. And all the friends there in California. And, you know, the interesting thing about working on the backstretch, you're like a pebble on a beach. You get rolled over a few times and smoothed off.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back here, and strangely enough, I didn't find my own countrymen nearly so welcoming.
Interesting.
It's a strange thing, that, but it was true.
Now, having had a taste of winning at the highest levels in the United States, and let's not forget all the good horses you had when you were a U.S.-based trainer, including Bates Motel, I'm sure you'd love to win a Kentucky Derby. But with the racing season the way it is in the U.K., with little to offer in the winter and early spring for flat horses, would that be something that you don't even consider? Would it just be too hard to pull off?
I think you might be able to put it off if you went through the UAE Derby route and you had a horse down in Dubai, because so many of your horses are so battle-hardened.
Mm-hmm.
By then, the three-year-olds, and they've been racing, you know, a lot. What Justify did this year was extraordinary. My son actually was with Bob Baffert and watching him have his first race and things in the winter, and that was an achievement and a half. I think what we have to face is, as we did the other day, with Roaring Lion, he got hit. He broke pretty good, but he got hit hard leaving the gate. Mm-hmm. And that dirt comes back in their face. Our horses are just not seasoned to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they immediately start climbing and hyperventilating, and then they don't run any kind of race at all. And I think that is probably our biggest problem, having a horse that can deal with the kickback and the sheer pressure of the race, because they go so fast from the gate and they run that first quarter so fast. It's pretty alien to European horses, that's
right,
for sure.
Right. And John, a lot of the very successful trainers here in the U.S. will tell you that they really do little else but work 24/7, 7 days a week. And I admire them, as most people do, for their work ethic. And I'm not saying you don't have a great work ethic, but I also found it interesting that you have many hobbies and other interests outside of horse racing. And tell us about some of those and you know, what if you find a quiet Monday afternoon where there's not much going on in racing, what would you like to do? How do you spend your day? What gives you pleasure besides the racing?
Yeah, I didn't take a day off the first 3 years in California, and that is so. Here we do have a downtime very much after the breeding stock sales in the November. So Christmas, New Year, early January are very much a downtime for us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can get a nice holiday there, whether it's skiing or going up in Montana or whether it's just going to look a bit of sunshine. So we do get that luxury because the horses are just having a pretty quiet time. There's no really serious racing of any nature. It's mostly jumps racing there.
Mm-hmm.
But during, I must say, during the season, I will, if there's a great opera on or a great play, I will make sure if I'm racing near London in the afternoon, I get there in the evening and we go and see all those things and then go home, get home late, doesn't matter. I think it's important for your mind to have other things that interest you, whether it's an art exhibition would be another thing we do a lot of. But you've got to fit it in the evenings. You know, the golden rule is you've got to be back. Ready there at 5 in the morning to go. None of the, you don't miss the morning's training. That is the most golden rule of all.
Terrific. Well, John, thank you so much for your time, and congratulations on Enable. And I sure hope that the Judd Mont team decides to bring her back next year, and we await that decision. Congratulations on a terrific year. And once again, thanks for taking part in the Thoroughbred Daily News podcast.
Thank you, Noah.
Thank you.